Welcome to The Reference Desk, a podcast where two librarians take you down the rabbit hole of the topics that have bewitched us.
So adjust the chain on your reading glasses, button up your favorite cardigan, and follow us punk-ass book jockeys through the stacks to The Reference Desk.
Welcome to The Reference Desk.
I'm Katie.
And I'm Haley.
And this is part two.
Hooray!
Of James Strang, the Mormon King of Beaver Island.
I am so pumped for part two.
Hooray!
Learning about America's royalty. Love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I cannot believe that this was like such a local story for me, and I only learned about it like a year and a half ago. Because the author of that book that I read, The King of Confidence,
He
gave a lecture at the local historical society.
Awesome.
And I just like happened to see it in their newsletter and I was like, what is this? The King of Beaver Island?
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I never heard about any part of this except for all the Mormons.
Yeah, no, that's all you ever hear about is like Brigham Young.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there was this guy, there was a couple others too, I think, that kind of took some groups of people and went their own ways.
Wow. After that coronation, I mean, right. I am ready to be a subject.
Did you watch the coronation of King Charles over the weekend?
No.
I didn't either. I mean, I just knew it couldn't possibly compare.
No, not at all.
All right. Are we ready?
I am so ready.
Okay. So when we left off, James Strang had taken a small group of Mormons to Beaver Island, which is like a small to medium-ish island in the middle of Lake Michigan. And he is starting his own like Mormon kingdom. And he has crowned himself king, or I believe more accurately, what was it? Imperial primate?
Yes. That's phenomenal. Imperial primate. Because when you name yourself, of course you have to name yourself a species below what you are.
I mean, it was accurate. Now that James Strang is an official monarch with his paper crown.
Totally official.
He began kind of stepping up his game and rolling out these new rules for his followers. First, he announced that God had given Beaver Island, along with all of the other Great Lakes islands, to them, to the Strangites.
Sure.
So therefore, the land did not belong to the federal government or to the Odawa and Ojibwe. Mm-hmm. So the Mormons didn't need to worry about paying for it anymore.
We're good, guys.
They were already like barely paying for it to begin with, but now he's saying that God had blessed him with the power to assign parcels of land to any Mormon pilgrims who moved there in exchange for just 10% of everything they owned.
Oh, that's it? Just 10%?
And then his next big move was he purchased a schooner for $1,000, which is about the equivalent of $34,000.
Okay.
In today's money. So, you know, decent amount.
Yeah.
Good thing that he's stealing from his followers. And he did that to kind of assist in this new financial venture, which was him and his followers began consecrating property. This is the term that they used, from non-Mormons and indigenous people, which just meant that they stole whatever they wanted.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So their justification for this theft was, quote, the natural and legitimate sequence of the doctrine that the Mormons are God's peculiar people who alone had the right to the earth and were eventually to possess it.
Oh. Wow. So they are the chosen ones.
Right. So basically they think that they're going to eventually inherit everything on Earth. So they might as well just start collecting it right now.
Oh my God.
Eventually their theft became so rampant that Strang earned the nickname the Pirate King. As if he needed another one.
Right. Imperial Primate. Pirate King.
as a reminder, when Strang came back to the island, he returned with a second wife who he had been disguising as a man.
Right, right.
Because one of his big tenets was that he was very against polygamy.
Mm-hmm.
But then he just returns with this woman, Elvira, and he just didn't ever, like, address it publicly. He didn't explain his feelings about polygamy, like if they had changed, but it was basically just this open secret that he had married this other woman and she was now living with him and the rest of his family. And Mary, the first wife, was not happy.
Of course.
And then shortly after the coronation, Strang and George Adams came to blows too.
Oh.
Because Adams had returned to Beaver Island right after Strang, and he brought a wife with him as well.
Ah.
And this wife was a rich widow named Louisa Cogswell, and Adams claimed that his first wife had tragically died of consumption.
Hmm.
But another islander received a letter from that first wife stating that she was still very much alive. But she was sick and destitute because Adams had just left her and taken everything and had only sent her a total of $2 since taking their son and running away to Beaver Island.
Oh my God. $2.
Two whole dollars. So it was not a good look for, you know, the prime minister of the Imperial Primate.
All of the titles.
So, sadly, shortly after that letter was shared among the Strangites, Caroline Adams did die, aww, remaining bitter about her husband's betrayal until, quote, she breathed her last.
Well, I hope she haunts him.
I know, right? She was fucking pissed.
Rightfully so.
And the new wife, Strang, was not a fan. Because it turns out that the Mrs. Cogswell widow was really a woman named Louisa Prey, who was a well-known theatrical dancer with a really bad reputation.
Mm.
Adams and Louisa had met when they were both performing in Boston at the same time, and Louisa just was like the town gossip. She liked to talk about everyone, especially James Strang, and especially Strang's love life. And Strang was not happy about that because he was like, listen, I know that I have a second wife, but we're not talking about it.
You can't bring that up.
Yeah. So a few weeks after the coronation, Adams left and went back to Voree, which was their settlement in Wisconsin, Wisconsin. And the local followers there wrote to Strang and said that he was telling everyone in Wisconsin that Strang had two wives, which was true. But again, we're not talking about that.
Karen, you can't just ask people if they have two wives.
Louisa was also spreading rumors that Strang had plans to marry the 15-year-old daughter of one of his followers.
Ooh.
Which apparently was just a step too far for Strang. I mean, Elvira was what, like 18, 19?
Yeah, she's young.
Strang basically told Louisa Prey she needed to leave the community. So Louisa pulled a knife on him and told him that she would plant it in his heart if she ever got the chance.
Oh my, okay.
In October of 1850, Strang banished Adams and his new wife from the island, and Adams vowed, quote, an eternal war and a war of extermination against Strang and his followers.
Extermination! Okay.
Again, this is why you do not bring in people who are just as unhinged as you are.
Yeah,
into your inner circle.
You can't have someone that wants as much power as you have, because it's not going to work out.
Right. So Adams did not waste any time getting started with that plan.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, he was serious. So after he was banished, him and Louisa went straight to Mackinac Island, which was the nearest Anglo-Saxon settlement, just about 50 miles east of Beaver Island. And when they got there, Adams told the locals all about Strang, accused him of all sorts of crimes, which were, again, probably true. And the people on Mackinac Island were already not fans of Strang because his followers constantly stole from them.
Right.
And were just kind of generally annoying because they had shown up and completely taken over the fishing and lumber industry in the area while not even owning the land that they lived on.
Sure.
So the county sheriff filed charges against Strang and arrested him, but Strang was set free on a technicality, so the sheriff arrested him again 3 more times.
Oh my God.
But he could not keep him behind bars because Strang was a trained lawyer and knew the law better than the local kind of bumbling justice of the peace.
Oh my God.
So he just kept getting away.
Wow.
Strang was also working behind the scenes with some local Democrat politicians, promising them Mormon votes in the upcoming election. So it wasn't even like this justice of the peace could really, like, go to the next higher up. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. District Attorney for Michigan, who was named John Bates, took notice of Strang's bad behavior and ability to seemingly just escape any kind of punishment, and he made it his personal mission to destroy him. Bates had political aspirations of his own and was a Whig, so he was worried that the Mormon support for Democrats could threaten his chances in the state elections. So he wrote personally to the U.S. Attorney General and kind of filled him in about this king on Beaver Island who was stealing land and stealing from all the locals, many of which were federal crimes because they were, you know, like harvesting timber that didn't belong to them and selling it.
Yeah.
He also claimed Strang was involved in counterfeiting activity. Again, he probably was.
Probably,
wouldn't
yeah.
be surprised.
God gave me this money.
Right. It's going to be theirs in the end anyway, so might as well. I know that Joseph Smith was doing counterfeiting in Nauvoo, so this like was not, this was not new to Mormons. Bates sought presidential approval from Millard Fillmore to send an armed ship to Beaver Island to arrest James Strang.
Oh my God.
So it's getting bad. He wanted attention, yeah. but not now he has it.
yeah.
And it's not great. Strang spent the winter of 1850 into 1851 aboard a steamboat that had washed ashore on Beaver Island. And was basically just left behind for Strang to look after until the crew could return to get it the next spring.
Oh my God.
So Strang just moves onto this boat and turns it into like his private clubhouse. And he needed that space, Haley, because he was translating a new series of 18 brass tablets.
He found more tablets?
Yeah, I know. Isn't it amazing?
Amazing.
On Beaver Island, of all places.
And they were already there?
They were already there.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Mm-hmm. He must really be chosen.
Yeah. Yeah. These were called the Plates of Laban, which apparently are mentioned in the Book of Mormon as one of like the lost books of the Bible. Luckily enough, Strang just happened to find them. So once again, he got out his trusty magic eyeglasses and translated the Egyptian Reform text into a 80-page document called the Book of the Law of the Lord.
Book of the Law of the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And all right. Those plates apparently gave Strang absolute power as a divinely appointed ruler.
Okay.
So he was now the maker, interpreter, and enforcer of laws, the distributor of property and patronage, overseer of infrastructure and internal revenue, military commander, chief justice.
Okay.
And Supreme Pontiff.
Wow. Wow. It's a lot of jobs.
It's a lot for one man. It's a good thing that he is the Imperial Primate.
I know. Nobody else could handle it.
Mm-hmm. Those plates also just happened to say, you know, go ahead and practice some polygamy, guys.
Just
it's
a little
fine.
Bit.
It's fine. Just a little bit. So that's how he finally handled addressing Elvira. He didn't mean for it to happen. It's not his fault that God wrote it and left it on Beaver Island.
Jesus. How do these people believe this?
It's a cult.
Yeah, it's a cult. Yeah.
I mean, that's, I guess, they believe that he has a direct line to God.
Yeah. Whew.
So on April 30th, 1851, Millard Fillmore, the president, who I think was probably the most forgettable president of all time.
I know.
I know nothing about him.
Nada.
He formally authorized legal action against the Mormons on Beaver Island.
Okay.
So while the government was planning to arrest Strang, he was already in hiding from all the locals, especially from Mackinac Island, where the sheriff had issued a $300 reward for his arrest because they wanted to try it again. Mm-hmm. So basically at this point, Strang had just like pissed everyone off. Elvira had given birth to a son.
Okay.
Who she named Charles in a nod to her old persona, Charles Douglas.
Oh my God.
Mary at this point was just hanging on by a thread. She fucking hated this.
Yeah.
The ship that George Bates took to Beaver Island to arrest Strang was the USS Michigan. It was the first iron-hulled U.S. Navy steamer, and it had the newest and most advanced weapons. I believe it went on to, like, do some important stuff in the Civil War.
Oh, okay.
It was a big deal. Like, they brought a warship to arrest this Mormon king.
He is the Imperial Primate.
Mm-hmm. They were not fucking around. And Bates also brought 40 armed deputy marshals and the senior officer of the state militia. So the ship stopped at Mackinac Island first, and Bates arrested James M. Gregg, who was the newly elected judge for Michilimackinac County and was a known Strang crony.
Oh.
Bates demanded that Gregg tell him where Strang was hiding and write him a letter urging him to surrender. Gregg refused, and Bates told him that, quote, unless he gave such a letter within 1 hour, he should swing from the yardarm as certain as the stars twinkled above it.
Wow. Okay.
Gregg said, all right. I'm done. I'm not dying for this asshole.
Yeah.
So he wrote a letter to Strang, urged him to surrender, and then gave Bates a hand-drawn map of where Strang was most likely hiding on Beaver Island.
Okay.
But 2 a.m. on May 24th, the Michigan anchored off of St. James, which was like the main town and harbor on Beaver Island, and Bates and his crew rowed into the bay with muffled oars and covered lanterns.
Oh my gosh.
They found one of Strang's advisors and got him to send a message to Strang and his hiding place. And when he emerged, Strang demanded to see the arrest warrant because he's, again, he's a lawyer. Like, he's not stupid.
Yeah.
So Bates was like, all right, it's on board the ship. And at 3:30 a.m., Strang boarded the Michigan, saw that everything was legit, was arrested, and headed toward a trial that was awaiting him in Detroit.
Oh, my God.
Also in Detroit at that time was Strang's old friend and former prime minister, George Adams.
Oh.
Who had promised to exterminate him.
Yes.
Adams and Louisa just happened to be performing Othello in Detroit at the same time. So they were like, since we're here, we'll just go ahead and testify against him at his trial.
Just real quick.
While all of this was happening, Mary and her three children departed Beaver Island. They were done. She was out.
Good for her.
Yeah. She moved her family back to Voree, where the Strang family still owned a house. And really, like, during this time when women had no rights and couldn't get divorced, it was really the best she could do to get away from him.
Yeah.
In July of 1851, Strang and 12 of his followers were tried for a series of crimes, obstructing the U.S. mail and assaulting a postal carrier with dangerous weapons, which Adams testified had happened the previous year when Strang grew obsessed with stopping critics on the island from sharing any news with the outside world.
Culty.
Yep, real culty. And he was also charged with trespassing on federal land to illegally harvest wood and counterfeiting. Strang addressed the jury of 2 Democrats and 10 Whigs directly, pleading his case by framing it as an attack on his religious freedom and comparing himself to Jesus. Does this sound familiar? The audacity of comparing yourself to Jesus.
To Jesus.
So jurors debated for just minutes before returning with a not guilty verdict.
No.
Yes.
Who is this guy? My God.
He was incredibly persuasive, just super charming, just could make people believe anything he wanted.
Jeez.
So yeah, him and all 12 of his followers were deemed not guilty. And 2 months later, prosecutors just quietly dropped all of their remaining charges against the Strangites.
Holy shit.
They got to go home.
Oh my God.
Strang decided that he was kind of tired of having these constant run-ins with the law, and he really just wanted to be above the law because he was the king. So he decided to approach this problem the old-fashioned way and ran for elected office.
Course.
And in November of 1852, Strang was elected state representative for a sparsely populated district occupying a quarter of the landmass of Michigan.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very few people were even aware that Beaver Island was a part of that legislative district. Mm. They didn't even know that Strang was vying for the seat since there were no standardized ballots.
Perfect.
Apparently, you just wrote a name on a slip of paper and put it in a hat and put your face against the hat and...
Good deal.
Read the stones. When Strang took all 165 votes on Beaver Island, he easily defeated his competitors, who split the remaining 200 votes. So not very many people voting at that time.
Okay.
But with this, he had officially achieved his boyhood promise to become a priest, a lawyer, a conqueror, and a legislator.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Pretty wild. I mean, he's achieved more goals than I have, so...
Yeah. No.
Good for him. Back on Beaver Island, at this point, Strang and his followers had pretty much complete control. The Mormons had taken over all the posts in the local government, and they were just tormenting any non-Mormons with petty lawsuits, which just so happened to fall under the jurisdiction of the local justice of the peace, who was James Strang.
Course.
They also took advantage of new legislation that required traders who sold alcohol to pay a large fee to local authorities. And Mormons, in theory, didn't drink, but the non-Mormons on the island sold so much alcohol that the northern part of the harbor was known as Whiskey Point.
Okay.
So once Strang started cutting into their profits, non-Mormons just began leaving the island. So by the time the election came around, there were really no one but Mormons on the island. And then to clear out the last of the Gentiles, Strang issued a proclamation that every non-Mormon come to the harbor and be baptized into the Church of Zion or leave the island by November 1st, which
what
just happened
fuck?
To be the day before the election.
How is that even possible? Oh my God.
It's awful. It's awful. But they're on an island. They're surrounded by Mormons who outnumber them. Mm-hmm. And have weapons, and I imagine it just had to be terrifying.
Absolutely.
So I guess you just go.
Sure.
Strang boasted that once all the non-Mormons had left, he was able to make peace with the local Native Americans, which
I highly doubt.
He wrote in the New York Tribune that until recently, the Native Americans, quote, excited by liquor and allured by the offer of a reward on my head, had been armed and hunting me for my life, but are now like members of my family,
sure.
having been saved from drink and poverty.
Dear God.
And then he went on to claim that it gave him great satisfaction to see, quote, a few of the vast race of red men redeemed from utter annihilation and be able to say, this is my work.
Ew!
So in celebration of all these fantastic achievements, Strang decided to go ahead and take himself a third wife.
Of course.
This time it was 31-year-old Elizabeth Betsy McNutt, who was known for being like the town snitch. Mm. She would rat out anyone to prove her loyalty to Strang.
Okay. Fangirl. Got it.
Yeah. And when he married her, the king began to speak more openly about his approval of plural marriage, and his two island wives lived together, with Elvira continuing to serve as his secretary and Betsy taking over the domestic chores. Lucky Betsy.
Yeah. I bet she was thrilled. Mm-hmm. Well, she probably was.
Yeah, probably. She's married to the king.
Yeah.
Strang also began to endorse a new dress code for women on Beaver Island.
Oh.
For several years, Elvira and a few others had been wearing pantaloons, underskirts, or dresses that came just to their knees. Amazingly, this was before Amelia Bloomer made that exact same outfit into a political movement.
Yeah.
They just started doing it first, which is kind of wild.
Yeah.
But now Strang was pushing for all women on the island to wear this uniform. Huh. And, you know, being able to wear something and being forced to wear something are very different.
Yup.
People weren't real happy. And it was really just another way for Strang to have complete control over every aspect of everyone's life on the island.
Right.
And that was kind of what started to plant the first seeds of bitterness among his followers.
Hmm. The pantaloons.
The pantaloons. The freaking too pantaloons.
Too far. Too
far. So when he went to join his legislative session in 1853, Strang's critics and enemies from the Whig Party attempted to prevent him from taking his seat by having him arrested on an old warrant when he arrived in the state capitol. But Strang was, again, just a better lawyer than any of them. Yeah. And he made a case that persuaded even the skeptics who had initially wanted him arrested.
The fuck?
Jeez. One paper said, quote, "King Strang pled his right in a masterly and convincing manner. He is a talented man equal to any other man in debate and information." Not only that, but Strang turned out to be a really good legislator and was widely respected by his peers.
Huh.
And he was so successful that when the session ended, he announced his interest in becoming governor of Utah.
Okay.
Which, of course, at that point was held by Brigham Young.
Mm-hmm.
But the federal government wasn't real happy with Brigham Young and were thinking about replacing him. I guess at that point, because Utah wasn't like officially a state, they could just like pick who they wanted.
Okay.
But in the end, Brigham Young retained the seat until 1858 on an interim basis because President Pierce's pick for the job was like, no, I'm not going.
No, thanks.
Smart man.
Yeah.
After kind of losing out on his bid for governor of Utah, Strang went back to Beaver Island, where his wives had had two new babies while he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And he resumed his throne there with as much dignity as he could muster. But reports of theft continued to plague Strang and the Strangites. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like, rightly so. They were stealing, like, very openly. Mackinac Island fishermen reported that Strang's men stole their nets and other equipment every chance they got.
Oh, my gosh.
My first thought was like, oh, boo-hoo, your fishing net. But then I'm like, oh, wait, like, they live on an island in the 1800s.
That's their livelihood.
Yeah. Yeah, those were not easy to replace.
Yeah.
And at this point, the Mormons, like, weren't even stealing from them because they needed the supplies or anything. They literally just were fucking with them.
Oh, my God.
Strang, of course, denied all of this, writing to the New York Tribune, quote, "Candidly, I most truly believe the story of the stealing was hatched up by some dishonest fishermen as an excuse of not paying up their arrears with the traders who supplied them."
Oh, my God.
Strang was appearing in newspapers across the country on a regular basis, and his name was more widely recognized than Abraham Lincoln's, who had just launched a bid for a U.S. Senate seat. Strang capitalized on that stardom by writing a book called Ancient and Modern Michilimackinac, which was a 48-page history of Beaver Island and the surrounding area beginning with the arrival of the French in the early 17th century. Because, you know, totally. There was no history before that.
Nope, none.
But the book's real purpose was just to serve as propaganda. The book painted local fishermen as the worst class of men and accused them of rape, murder, and robbery.
Jesus.
While the Mormons, of course, were portrayed as heroes, persons of limited means, temperate habits, good morals, and persevering industry who conduct their business as in the best regulated civilized societies. Strang also pursued a brief foray into climate science.
Oh, my God. Who is this person?
He wanted to do everything.
Everything.
Which, as someone with ADHD who also wants to do everything, I respect. At this time, there was no way to track storms or alert people of, like, incoming weather. They knew very little about weather. So the Smithsonian started a national network for collecting meteorological data. And Strang was like, I'll do it. or more likely, he put his name on the papers and then Elvira did all the work.
Sure.
For years, every day at 7 a.m., 2 p.m., and 9 p.m., Elvira went outside, observed the weather conditions on the island, wrote them into a log, and submitted monthly reports to the Smithsonian.
Oh, my God.
The information that Elvira and hundreds of other volunteers across the country collected helped scientists understand storm systems and laid the groundwork for early weather forecasting.
Awesome.
So it's actually, like, really cool that they...
It is, yeah.
They needed this, and they were like, let's just, like, crowdsource it.
Yeah. I love that. Mm-hmm. It very much reminds me, too, of, like, if you read, like, old journals where they're usually, like, such short entries for each day and they always have the weather in them.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
Yeah. It was so important to their life.
Yeah.
I guess it still is, but I don't know. We're not, like, growing stuff. I'm not.
Yeah. Nope.
I'm not. Strang also volunteered to collect specimens of local fauna and make notes on them. He wrote, or Elvira wrote, we don't know for sure, a paper called Some Remarks on the Natural History of Beaver Islands, Michigan, which was published by the Smithsonian in an annual report.
Okay.
In the 1854 election, Strang won his seat in the legislature again by a landslide. However, it's likely that the election was fraudulent since Strang received more votes than there were legal votes in his county.
Absolutely. Yep.
And included on the voting rolls were the names Napoleon Bonaparte and Charles J. Douglas.
Oh my. Yeah, he's hanging around voting for sure.
But again, like, just throwing a total curveball, Strang used his second term to fight for abolition, with one of his first acts being the presentation of a petition on behalf of Michigan's black residents, requesting that free men of color be granted the right to vote.
Huh.
His measure didn't pass, but Strang continued fighting for racial equality. During his session, he spent an hour and a half delivering a fiery speech denouncing the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, and he voted with the Republicans on a pair of bills designed to undermine the act by granting legal protections to accused runaways and other measures. And voting against his party was a massive political risk that really could and would cost him his career in politics. Mm-hmm. So I feel like maybe, like, this is a time when we see, like, a little peak of decency.
Weird. Yeah, that's, huh.
And, like, that he acted even though it was going to negatively affect him.
Right. He's not gaining anything from this.
Yeah. For, like, the first time, he's not being selfish.
Weird.
I don't know. It's very interesting.
Yes.
He was real terrible in all the other ways.
Sure. This doesn't make up for it.
Right. By 1855, Strang's followers had been accused of theft throughout the Great Lakes, from southern Michigan to Illinois to Minnesota. They were just stealing anything that they could reach by boat. The news of the thefts were printed in papers as far away as Australia.
Oh my gosh.
So it was a big
deal.
And there was infighting starting to happen within Strang's ranks as well. In July of 1855, Strang issued an official decree forcing all women on the island to wear pantaloons. This infuriated the women on the island, triggering a dress rebellion. And here's just a picture of what was traditionally worn during that time and then what Strang wanted the women to wear.
Wow. That's just so weird because that's considered like super immodest, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's why Amelia Bloomer and all of the other suffragists, well, not even all of them, because some of them were like, this is too, mm-hmm. too risky for us.
Right. Yeah. It was kind of weird. I don't know if it was like he knew that it was immodest and was trying to embarrass them, or if it was just like for his own like viewing pleasure of like,
sure. Okay.
I can look at your wife's ankles whenever. Yes. I want
oh
to.
Yeah. No, that makes total sense for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Strang also took another wife, this time 17-year-old Sarah Wright. Mm. And then he took a fourth wife just 3 months later, who was Sarah's cousin, 19-year-old Phoebe Wright. And at this point, Strang is 42. Mm. Not great. Pretty gross. So at that point, many women on the island began to fear that their own husbands would follow this example and start taking on multiple wives. Uh-huh. And most of the men were still firmly against plural marriage. They had brought their families to Beaver Island because they opposed polygamy.
Right.
So every time Strang took a new wife, it was like it just made them hate the practice even more. Mm-hmm. And it also made them start to question everything else that Strang said, because he changed his mind about this thing that was a fundamental aspect of this religion.
Right.
What was going to stop him from changing anything else?
Yeah.
It was, you know, kind of a time of uncertainty. In the state house, Strang was struggling as well. Republicans did not reciprocate the cooperation that he had showed them in the fight against this fugitive slave law. Mm-hmm. And Democrats were just fed up with the amount of power that such a small part of the state was wielding.
Yeah.
So the two parties signed a bipartisan redistricting plan that slashed the size of Strang's district, leaving him with zero control over any part of mainland Michigan.
Wow.
Oh, gotta love that redistricting.
Of course, yeah. This was before the parties switched, right?
Yeah.
When did that happen? That was after Civil War?
Yeah, because wasn't Lincoln a Republican?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Republicans now love using that argument. So Strang lashed out at his followers by doubling down hard on the pantaloons thing.
I will see your ankles.
Yes. Like, it kills me. This is the thing that brings him down, is fucking pantaloons.
Amazing.
Strang saw any woman who refused to wear them and the men who refused to make their wives wear them as a direct threat to his rule. Just fucking pantaloons. You could have had it all, Strang.
Yep.
In the spring of 1856, Strang summoned Thomas Bedford to the printing office on the island late at night. Bedford was a fisherman who lived on the island before Strang arrived, but had converted to Mormonism and married one of the Strangites. Like, he was a Mormon, but not, like, fully into the Strang thing. He was just kind of like, I want to marry this woman. I guess I'll convert.
Sure.
Bedford and his wife had openly opposed the dress code and had also accused Strang's kind of core group of henchmen of stealing 2 horses, 90 fishing nets, and 2 fishing boats in an attempt to silence them.
Goodness.
He had also been overheard agreeing to help a visitor to the island uncover who had stolen a boat from them on a neighboring island. When Thomas Bedford got to the printing office, he was met by a group of men holding horsewhips and hickory rods. Ooh. The men tied Bedford's hands and walked him into the woods where they lashed him 39 times.
Oh my gosh. Ugh.
For pantaloons.
Ugh.
Shortly after this incident, 2 men quietly disappeared from the island, leaving an angry Strang to call one a, quote, universal deadhead and common sponge.
A common sponge. That is phenomenal.
I know. I love it.
A common sponge.
That man, who was a drifter who called himself Atkin, would later be thought by some historians to have been a spy sent by the federal government.
Ooh, okay.
The other man who disappeared was Dr. McCulloch, who was a former favorite of Strang's, who had been stripped of his positions on church councils and political offices. He had told Strang, "Now it is you and I for it. You will destroy me, or I shall destroy you."
Hey, there's a lot of extermination talk and destroying talk. And
there sure is, for being God's chosen people.
Yeah, they're real
hell-bent on killing each other.
For mild disagreements.
Yes. So McCulloch returned to Beaver Island a few weeks later with pistols, and he and Thomas Bedford, along with some other detractors, began practicing shooting in the woods and discussing a plan to assassinate James Strang.
Okay.
They're done.
Yeah.
Their wives want to wear long dresses. If they have to kill a man to make it happen, then so be it. On June 2nd, 1856, the USS Michigan returned to Beaver Island. Since arresting Strang in 1851, the steamboat had been a frequent visitor to the island during its patrols, and it was customary for Strang to pay a courtesy call to the captain when the ship arrived. So Thomas Bedford waited along the path that he knew that the king would take, armed with a double-barreled shotgun. Alexander Wentworth, an outspoken opponent of polygamy who had engaged in public arguments with the king, waited a little farther along the route. Strang had called Wentworth an inbred whose father was his grandfather and whose mother was his sister.
Oh my God!
He has good burns.
I mean.
But when Strang passed in front of him, it was arm in arm with two other men, and neither Bedford nor Wentworth were able to get a clear shot at him.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, at least like they weren't willing to kill other men.
Sure. There's that.
So 2 weeks later, on June 16th, the Michigan stopped at the island again. It was unusual for there to be two visits so close together. The arrival was really unexpected, so it sparked a lot of speculation and gossip. The commander of the ship, Charles H. McBlair, sent a message to Strang asking for the prophet to see him to discuss some business. McBlair would later say he had wanted to talk to Strang about abandoning his schemes and dissuade him from his continued persecution of non-Mormons and to stop the blatant theft. We don't know if that was true, but we do know that McBlair had been in contact with the two men who were plotting to assassinate Strang for about 2 weeks. McBlair had talked with the men the last time he stopped at the island and dispatched an intelligence briefing about the situation on the island to the governor. So Strang greeted McBlair's messenger at his house, said goodbye to his four wives, and walked toward the harbor arm in arm with the man, telling stories and jokes. At the foot of the pier, Bedford and Wentworth waited with their pistols, hidden among a dozen other men from the island, as Strang walked past them. The pathway to the ship was really narrow, and it was lined on both sides with like big piles of timber that were waiting to be used as fuel.
Okay.
So there was nowhere to go. Like, this was like a cattle chute.
Yeah.
So as Strang walked toward the ship, Wentworth and Bedford followed about 20 feet behind him. And right before Strang got to the ship, a boy yelled out, "Brother Strang, they are going to shoot you." And the two men fired. Wentworth's bullet struck Strang in the small of his back and Bedford's in his skull. After firing their guns, Wentworth took off running toward the Michigan, but Bedford called him back and said, "We have to finish the job." So Wentworth fired at Strang from point-blank range, hitting him in the side of the face before turning around, running, and screaming, "That damned rascal is out of the way."
Well, okay. He could have chosen some better words, but...
Right?
This was your moment.
He said that your mother was also your sister.
You've been planning this. You had time.
But Bedford took some time to beat Strang's head with the butt end of his pistol before fleeing to the ship.
He was big mad.
I mean, he was lashed 39 times.
Yeah, fair.
Witnesses would later claim that Commander McBlair had watched the entire thing unfold from the deck of the ship, never so much as calling out a warning to Strang as the two men were sneaking up behind him. While their king was carried to a nearby house, Strang's followers wept and called upon the commander to turn over the murderers who had, you know, fleed onto his ship. Instead, McBlair sent his men onto the island to protect the families of the shooters and any others who they thought could be in danger.
Okay.
Amazingly, Strang did not die that day.
What?
Nope.
No.
Oh, yeah. He hangs on.
He shot four times.
Yeah, in the skull, in the back, in the face.
The side of the head, yeah.
Yep.
And then beaten.
Mm-hmm.
The fuck is this guy?
The following morning, McBlair went on shore and checked on Strang and found him in horrific shape.
Oh, gee.
Of course. He had severe head injuries.
You don't say.
And he was also paralyzed from the waist down.
Uh-huh.
But he was still able to speak.
What?
He asked McBlair to turn the men who had shot him over to the island authorities, but McBlair refused. In exchange, to try to kind of like even things out, he did send his own personal Navy surgeon to examine Strang. The surgeon was like, you ain't gonna recover. Not gonna happen. So after he pronounced the wounds mortal, McBlair, his men, and the seven Mormon families who had conspired against Strang steamed away on the USS Michigan.
Okay.
McBlair did turn the assassins over to the local sheriff on Mackinac Island, but we know how they felt about Strang.
Yeah.
So they hailed the men as heroes and offered them cigars, whiskey, and brandy in their jail cells.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Their trial lasted less than an hour, and then the killers were allowed to go free, being charged only $1.25 in court costs.
I killed a guy, and all I had to pay was a dollar.
And no other charges were ever brought against Strang's killers.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, they really hated him.
Mm-hmm. So if the assassination of James Strang was not fully sanctioned by the U.S. government, which a lot of people think that it was,
sure,
it was at least heavily aided in McBlair's decision to just let the assassins kill him right in front of him.
Right, right.
It's gross, but yeah, it makes sense. It kept the government's hands clean.
Mm-hmm.
And effectively just made the entire debacle look like it was a bunch of religious polygamous nuts just, you know, yeah, shooting themselves, destroying each other from within. So it kind of took care of this problem very neatly.
Absolutely.
Amazingly, 10 days after the shooting, James Strang was still alive.
No. How?
10 days. I don't understand.
So now his followers are like, well, he must be legit.
Right? I mean, that's pretty convincing.
Yeah.
When they found out that he was still alive, the two assassins and some other conspirators went back to Beaver Island, took hostages, and threatened to kidnap Strang before returning to their ship to plan another assault.
Oh, wow.
So at that point, church leaders were like, maybe we need to get him out of here. So they put him on a steamboat with Betsy and Phoebe and sent him away. He never got to say goodbye to Elvira, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
She really loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Strang was taken back to his family home in Vori, the one that Mary was now living in.
Uh-oh. She finished the job.
I would not blame her.
No.
Once Strang was gone, a posse of vigilantes swarmed Beaver Island, torching the buildings and rounding up whatever Mormons remained. Elvira did manage to flee, which left Sarah Wright, the 19-year-old who was pregnant, as the only wife still on the island.
Yeah.
She hid in the woods and the swamp for days while this mob just pillaged the settlement. Some 500 Mormons were herded aboard ships at gunpoint. All of their valuables were confiscated, and the boats took the Strangites to random cities around the Great Lakes coastline and left them all in small groups, hundreds of miles apart from each other, with nothing but the clothes on their backs.
Oh my God. Oh my gosh.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
But
they were also stealing shit from other people.
Right. Right. By doing that, they were basically assured that these people, like, they wouldn't find each other again. Like,
yeah.
They would never all come back together and rebuild this colony.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah.
Following the death of Strang and the expulsion of the Strangites, many Irish immigrants moved back to Beaver Island. And in fact, so many Irish people moved there that it earned the nickname America's Emerald Isle.
Oh.
Strang died with just an aide by his side on July 9th, over 3 weeks after being shot.
That is insane.
Mm-hmm.
That is just, oh my God.
I cannot imagine how much he suffered.
In the head, the face, the back. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks. Oh yeah. My God.
Even though he was in her house, Mary Strang was actually not even in Voree when James Strang died there.
Okay.
It's kind of like a common misconception that's printed in a lot of places that, like, at the end they had this beautiful reconciliation and he held, you know, her hand as he passed away. And she was like, she was not even home.
I do not have time for you.
Yeah. Elvira did not make it in time to see him before he died. Mm-hmm. She arrived a few days later. Mary remained in Voree for many years after James Strang's death. Briefly, she had Elvira, Betsy, and their children as neighbors.
Oh my God. That's not awkward.
I cannot imagine.
Oy.
She's like, I left an island to get away from you. Here you are. In 1870, she moved to Terre Haute, Indiana with her grown son and daughter and died in 1880 at the age of 61. Elvira lived with Betsy for a few years. They kind of moved around from town to town in Wisconsin, trying to find some other Strangites that they could start like a small settlement with. In 1859, she returned home to live with her mother near Lansing. She contracted a severe illness and was destitute. She was forced to place an ad in the local paper asking for people to take her children. Mm. 3 years later, she was able to buy the oldest three back, but she never regained custody of her youngest, James Jesse Jr., who was born after Strang's death. Mm. At 35, she remarried a non-Mormon. A man she called far inferior to her first love, and lived an uneventful life, dying at age 80.
I'm sure the new husband loved to hear that.
Right.
Jeez.
Unfortunately, at that time, though, as a woman, you really didn't have much choice but to get remarried.
Right. Yeah.
Betsy never married again. She moved all over the Midwest for the rest of her life, dying in Iowa in 1897 at the age of 77. Phoebe changed her name, a measure that she thought was temporary as she awaited Strang's kingdom to return to all its glory.
Oh, poor baby.
Mm-hmm. She died at age 78 in Tacoma, Washington. Sarah Wright gave birth to her son, James, in November following Strang's death and remarried 3 years later to a frontier physician who was possibly as bad as James Strang. He had abandoned two previous wives, divorced a third, and was already a secret bigamist when he married Sarah. He converted to Mormonism and moved his new wife to Utah, where he married six more women in the next 4 years and made a fortune prospecting for gold. But Sarah Wright left her husband and the Mormon church, but didn't want to leave Utah, so she studied and became a respected doctor.
Amazing! Good for her!
She earned about $2,500 a year, which is about $60,000 today. So, like, not great for a doctor, but unheard of in that time.
Absolutely.
And she was known especially for her skills in delivering babies.
Aw, that's awesome.
I know. I love that. In 1920, she spoke of Strang saying, quote, "I had faith that James was a prophet of God and would not do wrong. I don't believe today that God ever speaks to any men.
Oh.
Yeah. And she died in 1923 at age 87. Just like Joseph Smith, James Strang failed to name a successor before he died.
Oops.
Even though he had 3 weeks to do it.
You know, he's...
Oh, God.
I think he just, like, legit thought that he wasn't going to die.
I don't know. Or maybe, like, he didn't care about it continuing without him because it was all about him.
Yeah. Yeah. He didn't really care about any of them, so...
Stranded all across the Midwest with no one to lead them, the Strangites faced intense persecution and often chose to keep their beliefs and their past on Beaver Island hidden. Mm-hmm. They settled in with other Mormon communities, eventually just becoming absorbed by other sects. There is, however, a small number of active Strangites in the U.S.
Oh my God.
According to the official website of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Strangite, there are about 130 Strangites, most of which are in Burlington, Wisconsin. And Strangites choose to continue to follow the sect created by James Strang for the following reasons. Strang was the only man who received an appointment from Joseph Smith to be his successor, which was that fake letter. But they believe it was real.
Yeah.
He was the only one who claimed angelic ordination, the only one who had revelations during his administration, and the only one who was given the Urim and Thummim after Smith had used them. So, I mean, it worked for Strang.
Yeah. Still to this day. Wow. Mm-hmm.
The print shop that James Strang and his followers built to run the first newspaper in northern Michigan is today the General Museum for the Beaver Island Historical Society. Mm-hmm. It tells the story of Strang alongside the history of the Native Americans, early Irish life, and more. Mm-hmm. Today, Beaver Island has a year-round population of about 600 and is a popular tourist destination. I'm going to read the final paragraph from Miles Harvey's book because it's just the perfect way to conclude this story. Soon, Strang himself was relegated to the stuff of legend, his exploits sounding as outrageous and implausible to future generations as those of Johnny Appleseed or Paul Bunyan, and eventually the facts of his life faded into obscurity. But people like James Strang never really vanish. When the time is right, they reappear, wearing a new guise, exploiting new fears, offering new dreams of salvation. Americans are fixated on such figures, especially in periods of profound social and economic upheaval. And so it is that Elvira's desperate hope for her husband to return from the dead has come true. So it is that the King of Confidence lives on.
Ooh.
And that is what I know about James Strang, the King of Beaver Island.
That was such an amazing, wild ride. Oh my goodness.
I'm sad that it's over.
Oh, that was phenomenal, Katie.
I desperately want to go to Beaver Island this summer.
Yes. And see this. Yeah. Wow. Imperial primate.
Okay, so I have some recommendations.
Fabulous.
All right, so we'll do fiction first.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one is called Those Who Pray by Jennifer Moffitt. And this one is about a college freshman named Emily who is kind of struggling to find her place at school and find friends. But there's an exclusive on-campus group called The Kingdom that swoops in and gives her, like, everything that she was hoping for. So, like, you know, her friends, they accept her. There's cute boys. And they're like, hey, do you want to come with us to Italy this summer for a little missions trip? Mission? Missions? I don't know. Mission?
I think it's mission. I have no idea.
I guess it depends how many missions they're doing. But when they arrive, Emily and the other students have their passports and all their money taken away from them. They are cut off from their families back home, and they are subjected to dangerous and manipulative practices by this group. So this one is just kind of like a good example of how young, lonely, or isolated people are susceptible to recruitment by these kinds of like extreme organizations that we from afar can see like, nope.
Yeah.
Don't want that.
Yes. Absolutely.
But it's still like, it's not too heavy. It's still very readable.
That one's been on my to-read list for a while.
Really?
Yeah.
The next one is Sorrowland by River Solomon. I shared this one in one of the lists that I put up on Instagram during the Trans Rights Readathon. Mm-hmm. And when I did that, I really struggled with like what genre to put it in because it touches a lot of them. I think I ended up putting it in horror. Mm-hmm. But anyways, this is the story of Vern, who is 7 months pregnant when she escapes the religious compound that she was raised in. She gives birth to twins and decides that she's going to raise them in the forest until a confrontation with a being called the Fiend kind of changes things and forces her to confront her past. This is the kind of book where, like, you will not be able to predict the ending or even what is coming next. So if you like that kind of, like, thriller, it's really good.
It's also been on my to-read list.
And the next one is The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry. This book is set in late 19th century England, and it follows the story of Cora Seaborn, who is a new widow who travels to coastal Essex with her 11-year-old son and their nanny. While there, Cora hears about a rumor of a creature on the loose who's roaming the marshes and killing humans, but she is a hardcore skeptic and mega non-believer. And she is convinced that the creature that they call the Essex Serpent must be just a previously undiscovered species. Mm-hmm. So she meets a local vicar who is also suspicious of the rumors, but he is convinced that they are caused by moral panic or his people straying from true beliefs. And the pair of them end up in this entangled relationship as they try to uncover the truth behind this mythical creature. This was made into an Apple TV limited series starring Claire Danes and Tom Hiddleston in 2022. So if you don't want to read the book, go watch the show. And the last fiction is The 19th Wife by David Ebersoff. And this novel takes place partly in 1875 when Anne Eliza Young has just recently separated from her husband, Brigham Young. Ever heard of him? After being excommunicated, she sets out on this personal mission to end polygamy in the U.S., and it's interwoven with a modern-day murder mystery in which the gay and excommunicated son of a plural marriage family finds out his mother has been accused of murdering his father. Mm. And what I love about this is Anne Eliza was a real person who divorced Brigham Young and spent, like, the rest of her life advocating for anti-polygamy legislation.
Awesome! Go her!
Like, the courage!
Yes! Wow.
And she wrote an autobiography called Wife Number 19. So this novel kind of, like, pulls that story into this 21st century context.
Amazing.
Okay. And then for nonfiction, the first one is the one that I used for like 95% of my research. It's called The King of Confidence, a tale of utopian dreamers, frontier schemers, true believers, false prophets, and the murder of an American monarch by Miles Harvey. And this is by far the best, most entertaining account of Strang's life. I know that biographies like this can tend to be like super dry. Mm-hmm. And Miles Harvey does such a good job of crafting it into a story that reads more like fiction.
Awesome.
And another thing that I love that he does is, I don't know if you have this experience or not, but like when I read, especially nonfiction, there are all of these like little adjacent things that I want to know more about. Mm-hmm. And like I get very distracted by them. I either need more context or, like, I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. But Miles Harvey just gets that those are the places that you're going to want that and takes you, like, just far enough down, like, a little rabbit hole so that you have the context and your need kind of gets scratched a little bit. Because he, like, highlights the most interesting parts of the topic. when he writes about the real estate swindle that Strang and his friends may or may not have been trying to set up with the whole, you know, forming a religion thing. I was like, I wonder why during that time it was so easy to fool people, you know, into buying land. Like, Strang had already done it once. And then, like, the next few pages were just, like, this mini deep dive into the phenomenon of real estate scams in antebellum America and, like, how it turned into one of the first examples of people praising and turning into celebrities men who earn their money through duplicitous schemes. And, like, he just does that kind of thing, like, over and over through the book. But it doesn't feel like padding or filler. It just feels like he's just adding to the story. Really, really good. He wrote another book called The Island of Lost Maps that has won like a bunch of nonfiction awards that I really want to read. And then the next one for nonfiction is Under the Banner of Heaven, A Story of Violent Faith by John Krakauer. I love John Krakauer. He's such a good storyteller. So the main storyline of the book is the double murders that were committed by two Mormon fundamentalist brothers who insisted that they received a revelation from God commanding them to kill. But also woven in is like a really in-depth look at isolated Mormon communities that kind of bring this sort of belief into existence. He also does a really good deep dive into Mormon history, particularly following Brigham Young sect and the violent atrocities that they committed. Really good, thorough history of Mormonism, if that's something that you're interested in, combined with this, you know, kind of true crime. And that was also turned into a limited series starring Andrew Garfield. Did you watch that one?
No, it's been on my list because I know I'm going to have to be in like the right headspace to watch it.
Yep, me too.
So.
So that one's on Hulu. And then the next one is Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism by Chris Jennings. And this is just about the utopian communities that took root in America in the 19th century, which was really kind of what James Strang originally imagined Beaver Island to be. But this focuses on the Shakers, the Oneida community, the Icarians, New Harmony, and the Fourierists. I don't know that one. Each of the leaders of these communities were just as strange and interesting as James Strang. And this just provides like a lot more insight and context into this time and like the national mood that allowed these strange settlements to rise up and the reasons why they failed, like pantaloons.
Freaking pantaloons.
And then the last nonfiction is called Soul City, Race, Equality, and the Lost Dream of an American Utopia by Thomas Healy. I have never heard of this. This is about a utopian city planned by civil rights leader Floyd McKissick in North Carolina. And it was going to be open to all, but intended primarily to benefit Black people. The community received funding from the Nixon administration. They had planning help from Harvard and the University of North Carolina. And they were endorsed by the New York Times and the Today Show.
What the fuck? How do we not know about this?
America.
Yeah.
It was built on a former slave plantation. And it had roads, houses, healthcare, and an industrial area. But a series of external issues resulted in Soul City being shut down after just a decade. And its industrial plant, which was once a symbol of Black economic freedom, has been converted into a prison.
Of course.
Yeah. So I wanted to include this one because it's one of the few examples that I've heard of, at least, of like a utopian community being brought down from the outside instead of bad behavior from within. And it sounds like it was one that was actually going to probably be extremely beneficial. And of course, it's just like another piece of Black history that we just don't know about. Those are my picks.
Those all sound great. Wonderful.
Wonderful. Well, great. And a reminder, if you want to pick a topic for an episode, you can do that by signing up for our Patreon.
Hooray.
Yeah, thank you so much again to Meredith for giving us the go-ahead to finally do this topic.
This was so fun.
Yay. Yay. All right.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you for listening to The Reference Desk.
If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
If you'd like to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/thereferencedesk.
And if you're interested in purchasing any of the books we discussed today, visit our bookshop storefront at bookshop.org/thereferencedeskpod.
You can find us on Instagram at thereferencedeskpod, visit our website at thereferencedeskpod.com, or drop us an email at referencedeskpod@gmail.com.
This episode was written and produced by us.
Our music is C'est Salavie by Eric Harper, and our cover art for the show is by Maria Amaya.
Until next week, we'll see you in the stacks.